Good morning. We're going to call to order the Ag and Food Finance and Policy Division. Appreciate the speed that our pages and others assisted with this morning to be able to move a different committee out. And in about 2 minutes' time, they got us all prepped here for our committee. So I'm glad that that was able to happen. We are trying to be flexible with our committee time and our efforts anyway. We were going to be able to hear the governor's supplemental budget, but as everyone knows, we're really on a little bit higher alert on what's going on with the coronavirus, and so we're not going to have that information today. I think there's been other things that have taken priority, so we will not be doing that. That will be rescheduled for next week, and we'll certainly know a little bit more about what's going on by then. But we do have a quorum, and we do have in our packets, we have the minutes, and so Representative Brand on those minutes.
Madam Chair, I move the minutes from March 10th.
All right, the March 10th, 2020 minutes are in our packet. Anybody, any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. That motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. And also, we have a few bills today, so we're going to start with Representative Eklund. I know we're going to concentrate a little bit on farm safety today. We were going to have maybe some people from Farm Bureau come and testify or be here, but they canceled their Farm Bureau day at the Hill. So we may or may not have as many testifiers as what was originally planned for. But we're happy that we've got these bills, and we continue to do the work here. I know that they're in this 4072 is the bill that we're going to have. So Representative Eklund, if you'd like to move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I move that House File 4072 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Jobs and Economic Development Finance Division.
Very good. And then you also have an author's amendment.
I do, Madam Chair. I move the H4072 DE2 amendment.
All right. So we have the DE2 amendment, which is a delete everything amendment, and that's before us. So let's just move that and get that in the shape, and then we can have the discussion on the bill. So that's been moved. Any comments initially? All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. That motion prevails. So now the bill is in the shape you'd like it to be, and we'll just go ahead and have you talk about this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill came to me from the Farmers Union. It came out of some of the meetings that we had, hearings that we had earlier in the year. I got an email this morning about 7:15 from Stu Laurie saying he was sick and apologized. I told him to stay home. We didn't want him here. So, so we spent a lot of time talking about farm safety in this committee, and we've heard some incredible testimony, and we understand the greater need for farm safety. Serving on the Jobs and Labor Committee, I understand there are state financial resources made available for workplace safety that aren't reaching the farming community. For example, the Department of Labor and Industry has a voluntary confidential workplace safety consultation and grant program that provides up to $10,000 in matching grants to employers to make safety upgrades. The program was highlighted by Commissioner Lepink, during our farm safety hearing earlier this session. But she also shared very few farms are accessing these funds, and that's in large part because farmers aren't used to or particularly interested in working with the Department of Labor and Industry. Dolly has not yet gained a trust as a trusted partner in agriculture, but I think we can make a change in that, and I think the commissioner is obviously willing to work on that. So the reality sparked a conversation about how we could work through trusted partners like MDA or Extension to connect with farmers with existing resources. With the delete all, this bill calls on the Commissioner of Agriculture, the Commissioner of Labor and Industry, the Dean of Extension, and others to work together to develop some recommendations about how we can connect farmers with existing workplace safety resources. This has the potential to also help the resources we've been able to make available for grain bin safety stretch further. The goal is to provide technical assistance and resources that will support farmers who want to improve safety practices on their farms, reducing the risk to injuries. And with that, Madam Chair, that's a brief overview of what we're trying to do, and I can stand for questions. And I don't know, with Mr. Laurie not being here, who the testifiers even are today, because he was rounding those up for me. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Eklund. And as you noted, this is a bill that is going to go to the Jobs and Economic Development. They're the ones that have the money for those workplace safety grants. And so we're going to, you know, it's always nice to claw into other budgets for money for agriculture. And that's what we're going to try to do again with this one. So I think we do have Andrea Vogel here. If she has, you know, she can provide testimony. She can also answer any questions. So. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Andrea Vobel. I serve as Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and I'm happy to pinch hit for Mr. Laurie, who is homesick today. Thank goodness he stayed home. So we just want to echo our support for this. Farm safety has obviously been a huge priority for the department and for the governor. These workplace safety grants, we've noticed that is a program that we've not been able to get farmers to utilize, and so we certainly want to work with Extension and Dolly to figure out how we can better utilize those funds and help farmers use those resources. So we're supportive of this and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. We'll go to questions. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Chair Poppy. And Representative Eklund, is the intent here to make this more of education and training versus enforcement and regulations, and have it be voluntary programs or participation? Is that the goal?
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hamilton, yes, that was the main reason for the delete all. We wanted to bring a large group in and develop a program that could work, because we all know farming's can be dangerous work, but it also is necessary work that we have to have, and we'd like to make it as safe as possible.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Vobel, would you envision your work at MDA to end after you've had this get-together with stakeholders, or do you see MDA people in the field helping the farmers try to implement some of these voluntary practices?
Commissioner Vobel.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, that's a great question. I think we're certainly open to all kinds of suggestions. I know that's been one that's been floated, and you know, we're certainly open to figuring out a way to make that work if that's a feasible and reasonable thing that farmers would like to see. So, you know, we just want to make sure it's done right, and we have the resources to do it right. So, but yeah, we're certainly open to that.
Thank you. There was a fiscal note with this bill, and so it will go on to the next committee. We will revisit that fiscal note and implications for us and with this bill as it moves forward. But we wanted to make sure that we can try to, again, access resources where we can. And as Commissioner Lepping indicated, there's a lot of money available, but farmers aren't necessarily using that. And maybe there's a way for us to be able to encourage that. So. That's what we're looking to do. Any other questions? And just to open it up, people in the audience can certainly come down and testify in support or opposition to this bill. I don't see anyone coming forward, so Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. And this program reminds me of one that was started several years ago in the forest products industry. There's a logger certification program, certification and safety program. I don't know if they've accessed Dolly funds. I would have to look at that, but it's been a tremendous program for the loggers' safety in the woods, and I foresee something like this working in our farm community too. So with that, Madam Chair, I renew my motion that House File 4072, as amended, be recommended to be referred to the Jobs and Economic Development Finance Division.
Thank you. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and House File 4072 is on its way to Jobs. So thank you, Representative Eklund. Next, we have House File 3926 with Representative Brand. So now we go into two more bills that are going to be talking about farm safety. And so, Representative Brand, there are no amendments to this bill, but if you'd like to move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I move that House File 3926 be included into future consultation.
Okay, so to be laid over for future consideration. All right. So do you have, again, I'm not sure that anyone's here to testify, but if you would go ahead and present the bill, please.
I don't have any testifiers today, but I do know that, you know, you might remember a couple of weeks ago, we had some very touching testimony in the House committee here about Michelle Graham, the loss of Landon Graham, but not just Landon. There are other folks across the state and across the country that have unfortunately been killed in grain bin accidents just in the past year, but long over time. And what this bill would do is to provide up to $25,000 for the Commissioner of Agriculture to grant either the University of Minnesota or MinState system to create an application. And that application, like a cell phone app or possibly an electronic device, would do a couple of things. It would design to shut down remotely a grain bin power auger, and then also potentially to call 911. And, you know, just think about how long it actually would take you to use your phone to dial 911. It does take a couple of movements on your phone, or it could just be a quick button to press, and that could mean a difference between somebody passing away and somebody being alive. And so the bill is moving in the Senate. I know we don't talk about the other body, but I have had conversations with constituents in my district and the neighboring district to mine with the senator, and it just came to the conclusion that we could do something. This is kind of a novel approach to do something. There are grain bin apps, but they talk specifically about the amount of bushels that are in the grain bin using telemetrics and that sort of thing. But there's nothing out there in my research for safety. And perhaps this could be an example of something that could be done to help save somebody else's life.
Thank you. I think if there are nobody to testify right now, we'll just go to questions. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Brand, I appreciate the research and being able to control it, a grain bin, but I'm wondering, have we heard from any of our grain bin manufacturers, thank you very much, that would be already working on considering you know, doing this upgrade so that we didn't have this. My understanding is when I went home, I asked some questions about what the difference was, and they're usually called drag-out augers, and the drag-out auger that we had that's old, you could easily be in the bin and manage it. My husband said it would be very difficult to get hurt with it. But the new power augers that are in now in our grain bins, you would never want to get into.
Sure.
And that would make very good sense to be able to automatically shut it off and of course, encourage our owners to shut it off right away before they even think about getting in the bin. But, yeah, I'm just wondering if you've heard from any other manufacturers at all, if they're considering something.
Representative Brand.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Keel. I have not. I would imagine they probably aren't going to announce ahead of time that they are creating something like this because we live in a very competitive world and that sort of thing. I would just say that, you know, the difference between grain bin companies might make them not compatible with each other. You know, you talk about Apple and you talk about Samsung, for instance, two different devices. And I think the important thing to note is if this is public dollars going to a public institution, it makes the application public as well. And I think the benefit of that is that nobody controls it, and also that people will all have access to it. And hopefully that also means that it is compatible with both Apple and Samsung phones and that sort of thing as well. But I guess my goal is to create something that's a bit maybe more generic. And though I haven't heard anything specific from any grain bin companies that are making this, I know that they're working on different things. I know that grain bin manufacturers are looking at providing reinforced anchor points for harnesses, for instance, and stuff like that. You look at some of the older grain bins that don't have that sort of thing, and there's some compatibility issues already. You know, I grew up on a farm, and I realized that some grain bins are set off of a circuit breaker, and some of them still have the old fuse boxes. And, you know, the old meets new technology. I don't know many people that are going to probably spend the money to rewire their grain bins from the old fuse boxes to the circuit breakers, but what I do know is that going forward, having that application in place, that can meet the needs of the technology for new purchases and that sort of thing. I think this is worthy pursuit and kind of the novel approach to helping save a person.
All right. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Brand, not trying to get too technical here, but I don't like the idea of your bill, but
thank you.
If a farmer wanted to do this, would this signal have to go from his phone to a tower and then back to the grain bin again?
Representative Brand.
Well, that's a good question. That's not something that I can specifically answer. I don't have any advanced degrees in that sort of thing with telecommunications. Just my very novice idea, it probably would. That sort of thing. I do know that there are applications, for instance, that right now if I had an application on my phone, I know that this application exists. I could actually turn off the televisions if I knew what brand these TVs were in the room. And I could program that into a code. I could only imagine that something like this could also be employed to turn off a grain bin as well. And so that's my idea, that it would be not repeating off of a repeater, but more direct contact. But just like the television remote signal doesn't usually go around walls, and it doesn't go through walls very easy at home. And so, those are limiting factors, of course, but something I hope that can be, advanced with this consideration.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. Well, I've been in grain bins and never have had to call for an emergency yet, but, you're in a covered steel structure, mm-hmm. and if your reception is spotty to start with, I think you'd have difficulty reaching out to a tower to get that signal back again. And a lot of these augers are at the bottom of the bin covered by thousands of bushels of corn, so would that signal penetrate the layer of grain to get down there? So, again, I like your idea, but we have to be careful about building up some false security here to make sure that these systems would work.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Brand. I think one of the things to look at in this as well is if the public does prepare a device or does the research, there's a difference between a family farm where you are the owner-operator and your children or relatives are working there, mm-hmm. and a farm that has multiple employees and the responsibility, if there's a publicly available thing, that it's not the employee's responsibility,
sure.
To have the device, but it is the employer's responsibility to make sure that the devices are there for people. I think we tend to get lost in nostalgia that everybody is a family farm with the children of the farmer there, when in many cases you have multiple employees and you're in a different situation with an employee-employer.
Next on the list was Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Brand, I see the intention here. I think it's good. I just want to make a comment that I've worked around emerging technologies in agriculture, and actually some of the work I've done has been in, if you will, a private-public partnership, or public or private. And the concern that I have here is as Representative Anderson said, not only are there companies out there doing this, there's probably companies that are doing this because they have a liability. They're going to naturally be doing this. One of the challenges that you have when you have like a public institution like the University of Minnesota come up with some sort of IP, mm-hmm. Intellectual property, they don't share well with industry. Industry doesn't share well with higher ed.
Sure.
And so I think the intention's there, but my concern is that let's say this $25,000 grant went to basically a student coming up with a widget or coming up with some sort of thing like that. It kind of wouldn't extend beyond that. It's kind of the way the system is working. So I get what you're trying to do, and I think we all agree that this is something that needs to be addressed in the farm safety. I'm just not sure that this is going to accomplish what it is that you want it to accomplish.
All right, thank you. Well, I don't see any other questions, and I see no other testifiers coming down. So Representative Brand, just closing comments and any reaction to
what
you heard.
Yeah, absolutely. Bringing it back to the Grand family, at Landon's funeral, Michelle had told me that one of her relatives was there and said that he was going to actually start working on it. He was an inventor. He's going to start working on something like this. I'm not sure how easy or difficult something like this would be. And so having that public-private partnership would be important. And I think the intent of this bill is to make it more open source and less, you know, guarded technology that anybody can use. So my hope is that with this bill, we can actually do something that would help save a person's life.
Thank you. So with that, House File 3926 will be laid over. All right. So another bill that we have, talking about farm safety, it comes from Representative Anderson. So House File 3762. Then, again, this is a bill to hear and lay over. Representative Anderson, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'd like to move House File 3762. Have it be laid over for possible consideration.
Thank you. And I know that you have an amendment and then maybe some additional comments about an amendment. So if you want to address those amendments right
now. I'd like to move the A1 amendment, Madam Chair. And the reason for it, it's a simple amendment. And I also would like to, if the chair would allow, have another simple oral amendment besides its written one. On line 10, 1.10, it limits the payment to a farmer to $500. And I called a grain bin company yesterday and talked to the dealer. And they estimated to retrofit an older grain bin with the bracket system up in the roof and the labor to come out and do it. He said that $300 to $400 per bin, which would be okay here. But if a farmer has four or five or six bins, at $300 a piece, that would put the cost above the $500. So my amendment would just add $500 per bin. And then, Madam Chair, if I could add an oral amendment, it was my oversight down on line 21. This also talks about the safety equipment for silos. And again, the same thing I'd like to add there to make the cost $500 per silo, whichever is less.
Thank you for that amendment. And so I'm just going to have Mr. Sullivan just going to review it so we all know, because we'll do it off this A1 then, I believe. That's the amendment before us, so we'll add to that. So, Mr. Sullivan.
Madam Chair, that's correct. The technical way to accomplish Representative Anderson's intent is just to do an oral amendment to the A1, and the amendment would have the effect of changing the A1 after line 2, inserting another sentence that says, page 1, line 21, after $500, insert per silo.
All right, so we'll just have you incorporate that, so that becomes the amendment now. Is there any questions to that?
Not for me.
I don't think so. Okay, so I think that's your amendment, A1. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Okay, the motion prevails, and that amendment is adopted. And so now, Representative Anderson, to your bill as amended.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And not to be redundant, because we have other bills addressing safety, and I support those as well. This was brought to me by Senator Westrum over in the Senate, and he's the chair of the Finance Committee there, so some pretty strong support in the Senate for this bill as well. And again, we're hearing issues of safety in grain bins brought on by last fall's harvest of wet, poor quality corn, and we just pray that no more incidents occur because of taking corn out of bins now this spring as the weather warms up and such. So it's a situation that is dangerous, and we hope that farmers use all the caution they could. But what this would do, and again, in talking to my grain bin friend, was that at least the company he represents, he said about 5 years ago, all the newer grain bins have this bracketing or bolt installed in the roof. It comes from the factory that way. But so the older bins are what we would be trying to help be retrofitted here. It's a bracket, a certified bracket to hold 500 pounds, whatever, 750 pounds is what he mentioned, is what these brackets would be able to support. And then you have to have a pulley up in the bracket, and then some kind of either a rope or a harness system. And I couldn't imagine a rope around my waist being sucked down. So that would be cheaper, but the harness systems, he estimated the cost anywhere from $300 up to $1,000 for a really fancy and more secure harness system. So, again, this cost could range from $1,000 to $1,500 per bin. So, and we would really encourage farmers in those older bins to get this done for safety's sake, and would ask for the committee's support.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. We have some questions. Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Anderson, I appreciate the bill. But I was in listening to Representative Brand just before you. I'm wondering, for the auger systems that are on the floor, could we not also include in this some sort of equipment, retrofitting, if you will, that would be large enough for grain to pass through, but small enough that a foot wouldn't go in? You know, whether they cover the auger with a large, I know that in some grain elevators, there are metal, I don't know what to call them. I will say a slip bar, a slip guard, a screen, but it's large enough that grain has no trouble going through, and newer ones have it, but older silos may not. I don't know the right terminology, may not, but it would also retrofit those as well. So if we're adding bars at the top, could we not put some sort of cage at the bottom if it would be required to keep a foot from going in?
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, I think we're talking about a sweep auger at the bottom of the bin to clean it out. Yeah. And I have older ones in my bins, but they do have a cover over the top, but they have to be, as they move around the bin, there has to be an opening where the grain can get into the auger.
Right.
And I don't know how big that opening would have to be, but a lot of times you start these sweep augers when there's still grain in the bin, so they have to be strong enough to make it around with grain in the bin. And some systems, maybe more commercial systems, have lockout systems where you can't go in the bin unless that system is locked out electrically. And that would be ideal on farms too, but you know that carries a cost. So your idea is a good one, but I'm not totally sure how that would be designed. But yeah, it's something worth looking at. It would be eligible here too, I would think.
Representative Cleburne.
Well, that's what I want to make sure of, is that this money would be eligible for someone to, I mean, we're not engineers here. Yes. And in this committee. So just that it would be open and eligible for that. So I would then ask our researcher if that would, in fact, be covered under this bill.
Mr. Sullivan.
Madam Chair and members, I think it could be as drafted. House File 3762 on line 1.17 allows the Department of Agriculture to approve other grain storage facility safety protection equipment that would be eligible for grants.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Again, I don't see any testifiers. No one else is on the list for questions. Mm-hmm. So
I have a whole list, but
so Representative Anderson, any further comments before we lay this bill over?
Madam Chair, yes. Thank you. I should mention the subsection 2 of this bill. We had a tragic accident in Millerville this fall, yeah, where it was a silo, and as I understand, they were up on the top and were overcome by I think it was nitrous oxide poison gas. So this would also provide equipment for monitoring of the poison gases and silos as well, which would also be a good use for the funds.
Thank you. You know, and your comment is that is one of the issues we have, is that none of these seem to be identical to the next. So we have accidents, we have tragedies that are happening, and one solution isn't going to cover everything that has already happened or is potentially going to happen. So having a number of ideas is a good thing. So thank you, Representative Anderson, and we will lay House File 3762 over.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right, now we have House File 1293 with Representative Hansen. This one, I don't believe there are any amendments, but I do know there's a letter from the American Seed Trade Association in members' packets. They weren't able to be here, I don't think, to testify today, but they, and we also have a fiscal note in the packet, but that letter should be not in here. Sorry, that letter is not in here, but we will get that letter because we want to make sure that people have that. Be able to address that. So, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would move that House File 1293 be laid over for future consideration. And Madam Chair and members, I do not have an amendment, but I think if it's being laid over, I would maybe recommend a clarifying amendment be added, that this would be for the effective date of January 1, 2021 for the next crop year, because the default would be an August 1 date, and there would still be seed out in commerce from this year. It'd be hard to go back and tag that. So I think that's something, I don't know if we could do that here as an oral amendment or if we should do that later.
Okay, I think we'll make sure that Mr. Sullivan understands what that request would be so we'd know in the future. Mr. Sullivan.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, I heard the 2021 portion, but I didn't hear what you said before that for the date.
That the effective date be January 1, 2021, because otherwise the default effective date would be August 1st of this year, and it would be hard to implement during the calendar year. So I just was reading that, and I thought, oh, we're in an automatic default date, so it would be better to clarify that it's for next year.
Representative Hamilton, would you be okay if we actually had that as an amendment at this point?
Excuse me. Yes, Chair.
So I think, Mr. Sullivan, would you be prepared now to be able to describe the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair and members. The amendment, because there are two sections, it's necessary to just insert a section 3 on page 2. So page 2 after line 10, insert section 3, effective date, period. This act is effective January 1st, 2021.
All right. Thank you. And so we'll just move that. Representative Hansen, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Okay, that motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So now, Representative Hansen, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the bill as amended. First off, as I often have to do with pesticide bills, I want to be clear that I'm not using this as a vehicle to be amended on the floor. I have no intention of adding anything to this. Representative Hamilton, this is what it is. I view this based on past communications as we've been in committees that this is an informational label. It is not an informational tag, like a seed tag, that we're dealing with the seed tag law, not the pesticide label law. So we are not, I am not proposing changing a pesticide label, because the label is the enforceable. I view this as like the Surgeon General's warning on a cigarette package. So I've heard communication that farmers may not know the impact of the seed treatment, but that includes a neonicotinoid pesticide. We have continual published data that neonicotinoid pesticides are affecting not just honeybees, which are an introduced species, but native bees, native pollinators. Our University of Minnesota has provided constant updated information on that. So the actual informational tag that is there says, planting seed treated with neonicotinoid pesticide may negatively impact pollinator health. Please use care when handling and planting this seed. So I think this is an informational tool that can be used to help with care with the corn and soybean seed to help provide information, and it is not an enforceable label. That label is on a pesticide that is applied to the seed, not to the seed corn. So that's the bill, and I would ask for your support.
All right.
And I have a couple testifiers, Madam Chair.
Let's bring down those testifiers first. And while we're doing that, I'm just going to announce that we have students from Riverview Dairy So this is the group from Riverview. We're going to have another group from River Bluff at some point. So let's pay attention here. But we will. So I think these are students that are making their way today. Perhaps they'll have conversations with others of you. They're here to see the process, and I talked to them this morning. I told them about a couple of these bills, and so they're They're kind of eager to learn more about what we're doing here. So welcome to the committee, and I'm sorry to interrupt you. So please identify yourself and then provide your testimony.
Okay, thanks. Hello, Chair Poppy. Thank you for having me. Thank you, members of the committee. Thank you to the Riverview. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Erin Roop. I run Pollinate Minnesota. I served on Governor Dayton's Committee for Pollinator Protection. I'm a beekeeper. I have 5 hives right now. I'll have 25 hives in April. That's small scale, right? commercial beekeepers have the definition is 500 colonies. I'm also an educator, so I keep bees at places like Minneapolis Public Schools and libraries and parks. And this year, a fifth grader told me after our class with everybody in beekeeping suits hanging out with the bees all together that she had had 2 fears her whole life, death and bees, and now she just has 1. So bees do this work, right? They're really cool flying insects that drive student bravery and experiential learning while being totally essential to the functioning of our ecosystems and our food systems. So 1 in 3 bites of food we eat comes to us through honeybee pollination, and that pollination contributes $24 billion annually to the U.S. economy. There are also species that we care about, right? Serving on Governor Dayton's Pollinator Committee, we had diverse members, but the value of pollinators to our ecosystems and food systems was never debated. And we all agreed that healthy pollinators are critical. I would also say we agreed on the drivers of pollinator decline, that habitat loss and parasites and disease and pesticide exposure contribute synergistically to pollinator decline. We didn't come to total consensus on priority actions or the extent to which each driver was a cause. But insect declines are real. We're seeing them in Minnesota. Beekeepers here in our state, folks who know what they're doing, right, with generations of experience, on average lose 1/2 of our colonies every year. I'm not a generational bee. I only have, 12 years of experience. Maybe I lose more. Our new state bee, the rusty patch bumblebee, is federally endangered. Our 469 Minnesota bee species all live in the same ecosystem, and we're learning more about their populations. Over the last 2 decades, agriculture has become 48 times more toxic to insect life. And we see this every day. Think about turning on your porch light in the summer, about driving across the state, and the work that you no longer have to do cleaning windshields, and how different that is from what we experienced when we were younger. Neonic insecticides are responsible for 92% of that surge in toxicity. And imidacloprid, one of these neonic chemistries, is the most widely used insecticide in the world, and most of its use is as a treatment or coating on a seed. The pesticide use on neonic seed treatments accounts for millions of pounds of pesticide on over 100 million acres. About 94% of the corn seed available is pre-treated, basically everything that isn't organic. About 1/2 of the soy is. In Minnesota, planting treated soybeans doesn't improve your yield, and there's more research to suggest that the same is true for corn. All these seed coating applications are considered treated articles by the US EPA and exempt from data collection on pesticide applications. We know this class of pesticides to be a driver of pollinator decline. We also see impacts on deer health. Our DNR will be releasing the outcomes of their study of 800 deer spleens later this month. I've been thinking so much about just what 800 deer spleens looks like. the size of that. MDA has also just preliminarily added the 4 main neonics to their surface water pesticides of concern list. The global neonic market generated $4.42 billion in revenue in 2018, which is roughly doubling what they had been gathering over the previous decade. And it's pretty safe to say that a large chunk of that $4 billion is from seed treatment applications and sales. It's really heartbreaking to contrast that to individual farmers' income right now. Average U.S. farm income, as you all know, was negative $1,500 in 2018. Seed coatings are this big data loophole right now, not just in our ability to understand pesticide exposure avenues for pollinators or for deer or for water, but for farmers themselves. A new paper that will be published in Bioscience later this month is extremely relevant to this bill. I'll share it with committee members and bill authors when it's published, but I apologize, it's not out yet. I couldn't share it today. But part of that research summarized that farmer knowledge of the chemistries that they apply. So one of the authors provided the summary. Close to 100% of farmers know the names of pesticides applied to their fields aerially, yet a lower percentage of farmers knew the products put on the seed they planted. So this has been my own experience too. One of my Wisconsin bee yards neighbor's land a conventional farmer rents for corn, soy, or barley. He rotates, right? He tells me what he plants because we know that neonic exposure to my hives when seed goes into the ground is enough to kill my bees. So the first year we talked, we looked at the seed bag together. I learned that thymethoxin is a neonicotinoid. We learned that together too. That was 2015, but this bioscience research demonstrates that that knowledge gap still exists. And this bill proposes the addition of a bee caution statement on each treated or coated seed label that would serve to close that information gap. A treated seed program was the first named action step in our MDA's 2016 special registration review of neonics. This idea was the governor's committee's third priority pesticide recommendation, Governor Dayton's committee. This bill doesn't do the data collection a treated seed program would. It simply adds a label. So at the farmer level, people who are making decisions about how and what to plant can make the choice they want to. It firmly focuses on farmers and farmers' ability to tailor pesticide use to production and environmental goals. Now is the time to support individual farmers and not the $4.42 billion guys. I express my support for House File 1293. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We have a second testifier, a Margaret Monson. And now I'm going to introduce, before we get Margaret up, a group of 9 to 12 graders from River Bluff Education Center in Red Wing. They are here as part of a Historical Society Voice of the People program. So I believe that would be your group. Is that correct? Yes? Okay. Very good. So now we've got welcome to them from River Bluff. We have River View students here, so we were talking earlier, and so we're happy that we have all of these students from southern Minnesota and northern Minnesota and all throughout the state. So welcome, and welcome to the testifier.
Thank you for having me. My name is Margaret Munson. I live in St. Paul. I'm an educator, an entomologist, and a beekeeper, a small beekeeper. This bill will aid in communication between farmers who use these chemically treated seeds and other landowners and beekeepers. It will serve as a warning to remind farmers and applicators of the impacts of these pesticides on pollinators, because these are systemic pesticides. That means they're taken up by the entire plant, and for pollinators, it means they're in the pollen and the nectar. The coating on chemically treated seeds is known to come off and drift, and there are many reports of contamination of adjacent properties, including beehives. In fact, only about 5% of this chemical is actually taken up by the plants, so the rest of it ends up in the environment, in the air, the soil, the water. The labeling will be a reminder that research has confirmed that these chemicals in pesticide-coated seeds not only impact pollinators, but the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is finding these chemicals in the water. It's affecting the aquatic insects. Fish and other animals depend on aquatic insects, so it's becoming pretty pervasive in the environment. Our keepers of the non-native honeybees, obviously very important in pollinating a lot of our crops, are experiencing serious losses throughout the country, as Aaron mentioned, as much as 50% sometimes. But we have 470-plus species of native bees in Minnesota. Of those, about 20 are bumblebees. They are experiencing decline. Bumblebees are the most efficient of our native pollinators. In addition to the rusty patch, which has been labeled, we have several other species that are being studied now by researchers that are thought to be in decline. We need to protect and conserve our honeybees, but remember that our native pollinators, in addition to pollinating lots of fruits and vegetables, they're absolutely critical to the integrity of the health of our wild places, forests, prairies, wetlands, bogs. All those places are not kept going by honeybees. The native bees are keeping these places strong. So please support 1293, making labeling more effective and reminding and alerting farmers and applicators to the serious impacts of coated seeds on native pollinators, honeybees, and other wildlife. And thank you for having me.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience that wanted to testify in support or opposition? We've got another person coming down, and Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just while the next testifier or testifiers are coming down, I wanted to zoom in on why a little bit on the details of what happens and how that, why this is important. So think of your corn seed in a bag, and it is not spherical. It has ridges and edges. The old purple seed treatment was Captan, a fungicide, but there's also neonicotinoids in that seed treatment. So in the bag and in the planter, that seed rubs against each other. And as it rubs against each other under that vacuum, there's small particles that come loose. And those particles have the neonicotinoids. So you've got the planter under the vacuum in your planter. And when that is released, you have a release of those small microparticles that include, and it may seem very small, but particularly for the native bees, which the toxicities are done on the honeybee, not the native bees, because we have native bees could be the little bitty sweat bees or a bigger bumblebee. We don't have the data, but the data that we do have shows that they're impacted, particularly think of a bumblebee. So with a honeybee, the workers go out and do the work. They protect the queen. The queen does not go out and do the work. So the honeybees go out, and they may become disoriented as they're exposed. With the bumblebee, the research that has been done at the University of Minnesota shows that queen is by herself. She has to go out. And when she goes out in the spring, when corn is being planted or soybean is being planted, she becomes exposed because what are the first flowers that are out? Dandelions or willow. So the dust that is occurring as the seed is being planted and the planters are being vented, the material gets out, they get the exposure, the queen dies. When the queen dies, there's no baby bees. So the impact on the native bees, whereas with the honeybees, you can have the impact on the workers, but the queen is protected unless they get back and bring that into the hive, and we're already finding that it's in the honey because they bring it back. So this is why we're trying to do some information here. If this is the method, we can get you the data that has been, the published information that's happened. We've been talking about this for many years, but that's why we're trying to do just an informational thing of what is happening so that the farmer can know. And with that, Mr. Cohen.
All right, welcome to the committee. State your name and then provide your testimony.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Chris Cowan, and I work with the Pesticide Action Network and the Minnesota Environmental Partnership Pollinator Cluster. I just wanted to speak briefly in support of this bill, and in doing so, just talk about how many of us have been coming up here for several years now, and are we making inroads? Have we turned a corner yet on what's going on with pollinators? And I'd like to just talk about honeybees in particular. In many cases, it's easier to relate to honeybees. People all know about honey and about the bees more so than some of our native bees that if you haven't seen them, it might be harder to relate to. But at any rate, many beekeepers from Minnesota go out to California to pollinate almonds. It's an annual event now. 80% of the almonds in the world are produced in California in the Central Valley, and 100% of the almonds in the United States are produced there. Now, a little bit of math here, and you can verify this by going to the California Department of Agriculture or the Almond Board in California and the USDA. That's where I got my numbers. By the way, I was just out in California and had a chance to see the process firsthand in the Central Valley and to talk to beekeepers out there. So for almonds, there's 1.4 million acres of almonds out there. And for pollination, because there's no pollinators there, and I hate to say it, but it's because it's a monoculture. The restaurants only open a couple weeks out of the year if it's just all almonds. They need to bring in honeybees, and they come in from all over the country. So 1.4 million acres of almonds needs 2.8 million colonies of bees. So you need two hives per acre. And the reason you need that is, one, that's what you need for to get the pollination services so that the trees get pollinated. But two, for the almond growers to get their crop insurance, they need to show that they have a contract to have those bees. Now, the problem is that if you go to the USDA website and look up how many commercially available honeybees there are right now, that number shows at something just a little under 2.7 million. So if every bee that the U.S. Department of Agriculture, if every colony in the country went to California to pollinate those acres, they're still they're short. And this is becoming more and more of a reality of what's happening in California. I talked to one Minnesota beekeeper who last year, mid-year, at peak flow, had, and this is moving the bees around, they're not in California all the time, had 2,500 hives. When he buttoned up his hives in the fall, he had 1,500, and when he opened them up in the spring, he had 800. That's just one example. The beekeeping losses across the board are still as high as they've been. One other thing to think about when you know, the USDA views honeybees as livestock. So if we look at these farmers and their livestock, there used to be 4, 5, 6 million kept bee colonies in the United States. And as I said, there's now 2.7 million. And the other thing is that a lot of the beekeepers are not as young as they used to be, and with the pressures of trying to keep bee colonies alive, it used to be easy, is what people have told me. I'm also a hobby beekeeper, and I hear about how easy it has been to keep bees and how it isn't now. Folks are getting out. So there's a relatively small number of people who are providing these very key services, and this transition is taking place, and the numbers are getting smaller. So for all those reasons, I just wanted to let the committee know kind of what I've learned recently about what's going on with kept honeybees in the United States. And for those reasons, just another way to help support those folks and native pollinators, I ask for your support on House File 1293. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. And we do now have, it was distributed, the letter from the American Seed Trade Association. So people have that, should be able to refer to that. I think we have some questions. So we'll start with Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, I understand the making sure that people know what they're using. A little offended by the fact that farmers don't know what's on their seed. That comment was made. That's very rarely true. You're making sure what you put in the ground is what you ordered and how it's put in. But my other question is, I believe there are other deadly things that happen to bees besides neonicotinoids. Do you know what those are?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Keel, we have been dealing with all the other stressors for the last 10 years. We have invested millions of dollars on pollinator habitat. We have established a bee lab to look at those stressors. We have spent money on parasites, whether it is the varroa mite. We've done all that. But whenever we come to pesticides at the Minnesota Capitol, we are unable to do anything. We've spent the people's money, huge amounts, on publicly financing pollinator habitat. Whether it's in farm country, we've established our DNR on public lands, the Board of Water and Soil Resources on private lands, the bee lab, millions of dollars for the bee lab, staffing the bee lab, which I would encourage people to go to. So it's poor habitat, poor nutrition, parasites, and pesticides. All four of them. But when we don't deal with pesticides, we can plant all the habitat we want, but if they get in contact with something that kills them, it was for naught.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you know, I want everyone to understand there isn't just neonicotinoids that bees may have trouble with. And when I hear about traveling bees, which, you know, in my district, I know they go other places. They travel quite a bit. Makes me wonder where they're picking up all their, you know, when you close up a beehive and it goes traveling to California, how do we know that it's not picking up varroa mites there? How do we know that it's not picking up not just parasites but pathogens, that illnesses that kill it, kill bees? And I understand the importance of pollinators. I just I just want people to understand there's more than one thing that happens here. I know we've put a lot of money into this. I understand that, but just want to reiterate the fact that I've talked to some of the companies that do put coatings on seeds. I understand what you're talking about when you talk about the dust. I have planted, totally understand that. And the importance of making sure that seed actually comes up is why those things are done. And the companies that I've talked to have told me they are working on a better way to seal those seeds so that when it goes in the ground and the pesticides are taken up for protection of that seed, that in fact it works. And, you know, we do testing in our ground too, our dirt and our soil. So we are aware of what our soil content looks like and its health. So I just want to reiterate, there's more going on here than just throwing seed in the ground and not being concerned about other habitat. Thank you.
Next, we have Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with what Representative Keel said. And I would like to ask the first testifier to come back up and respond to the question.
All right, so that would be Ms. Rupp. Welcome to the committee, and Representative Anderson has a question.
In your testimony, you mentioned that there was no yield increase for soybeans. You even mentioned corn. Could you tell me where you got that research data from?
Yeah, I meant to track down those. I can share that with the committee later today. I'll track down those studies. I think there's been, you know, five now. I apologize for not. This is Erin Roop, by the way. I should say my name before I speak, right? For not having that for you today.
Several land grant, Madam Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Several land grant institutions, and I think if you even check with our terrestrial invasives researchers, particularly on soybeans, that the yield benefit is non-existent.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen qualified that. You know, farmers aren't stupid. And if there was no yield increase, why would we spend $15 an acre putting something in the seed? That's frustrating that there's thoughts out there that, hey, you're just doing this to kill bees. That is so far from the truth that the
manager.
And I would, especially in corn, there is a definite yield increase, or we wouldn't use it.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, no one said that farmers were stupid, and no one said that they're. If you have 95% of the market and you have no choice, if there's no choice of the seed, if 94% is treated, and with soybeans, if 50% or 50 plus is treated.
Representative Anderson.
But again, Madam Chair, for the cost of the additional cost of the seed, if there were no yield benefit, farmers would say, I don't want it. And it's frustrating. I could also ask a question. When is the usual time hives are put out in the springtime to the testifier?
Ms. Roop.
Yeah, so I mentioned that I have five now and 25 in a bit. So packages come to the Midwest around early April, mid-April. And commercial beekeepers who are out pollinating almonds, which Chris talked about a bit, come back to the state usually after you all have seed in the ground. And I also wanted to speak to, I heard the farmers that I served on Governor Dayton's committee with. I talked with farmers in my neighboring farmers where I keep my bees and throughout this work, right? The farmers are key to the puzzle of what's going on for pollinators, and heard that, I mean, you have 40 opportunities, 50 opportunities to plant in your lifetime, right? Each one is important. And folks are buying those seed coatings as insurance, maybe to get that, you know, I mean, it's hard to be a farmer right now. It's hard to be a beekeeper right now. And I also want to reiterate what Representative Hansen said about, I did not mean to imply that I do not think anybody is stupid. And I, yeah.
Representative Anderson?
I didn't accuse you of saying that, but the implication is that, you know, why would we use that if there was no yield increase? And I think I've mentioned this before. You know, I have a pasture and a beekeeper that keeps his bees in my pasture, and he doesn't put his hives out until I'm done planting in the spring. And he's fine with that, and we get along that way. And so I think there's ways we can work together, because we all want to see our pollinators survive and thrive. And I think by working together and communicating, we can do some good.
Thank you. Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Anderson just said exactly what I was going to say. In those closing comments of yours, I know that everyone in this room wants a healthy farm economy. And you and I have had conversations about the fact that every farmer knows that their land and their water and their even their insects and soil, all of the things that make up your soil, are important to a vibrant economy for farmers. So I just wanted to say, I wanted to extend that respect to our farming community and make sure that they know that we see them as professionals, and this is an opportunity for us just to all work together for something good for our state. Thank you.
All right, Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank Representative Hansen for this work and this bill. I think we're all growing in awareness of how interconnected we are as human beings to the land, water, and other creatures as well, and how interconnected different parts of food production are with other creatures also, and how critical pollinators are to our lives and the ecosystem as a whole. So I see this bill and this label as a step in nurturing that awareness. And I think it's important. So I thank you.
All right. I don't know that I see any other. Oh, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, one of the concerns that was brought up in the letter that was put in the packet, that this may conflict or the language in the bill may be preempted by federal law. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Representative Hansen.
I think what the label is referring to is if it was a labeling, and that's why it was clear the difference between tagging and labeling. So if I was trying by law to change the label, the pesticide label on that, yes, that would be preempted, or there would at least have to be dealing with FIFRA, which is the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, and that authority goes to the Department of Agriculture. So I want to be clear as I can for the record. I am not talking about changing the label. I'm talking about putting an informational tag on the bag so that they can be informed. It is not a regulatory. It's an informational thing. So we talk all the time about informing and communicating and trying to get more information out to people. What could that harm to try to provide for more information? This is not an enforceable label that is there under FIFRA or the Minnesota Pesticide Control Law.
Representative Hamilton. Okay. I don't think there are any other testifiers, and I don't see any other questions from the committee. So closing comments before we lay this bill over.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. We have been in front of committees for nearly 10 years trying to deal with this, and we have been we've had regulatory proposals, we've had enforcement proposals, we've had funding proposals. We will continue to have funding proposals. And I think this is an educational, informational proposal. I think it is a small step to try to help raise awareness on proper handling and proper use so that we can reduce the impacts. And we do know that neonicotinoid seed treatments impact native bees and honeybees. We know that. And so I'm asking for your support to help with this non-regulatory information educational approach that I will not amend on the floor to anything else.
With that, House File 1293 will be laid over. Next up, we're going to switch from bees to wolves. And we're going to hear from Mark Abrahamson about the Wolf Livestock Prevention Grant Pilot Program. That was funded about 3 years ago, and this is a year to require the report back. And I know last year, Representative Tapp, he had a bill to continue funding, but we wanted to hear what the report was. And I know that there was also some federal dollars that came to the department for this. So welcome to the committee, Mr. Abrahamson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my name is Mark Abrahamson. I'm the Plant Protection Division Director at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And I'm going to give you a summary of the report we prepared for the legislature on the wolf livestock conflict prevention grants. So this was appropriated for fiscal years 2018 and 2019. There was $120,000 per fiscal year to grant to livestock producers to take measures to protect livestock that were not lethal to wolves. And so there were a few categories that were eligible for grant proposals: guard animals, veterinary costs associated with guard animals, barriers for wolves such as fences, lights or alarms, and shelters for calves or other vulnerable animals to protect them from wolves. So what we did when we began this, we created an application, a simple application for producers to fill out. And then the scoring criteria were such that we were really trying to direct this towards people that were having significant recent losses on their farm. So the biggest score that a producer could earn on this application was having a lot of losses to wolves recently. And then other factors such as how good of a plan they had also came into play. We put together a panel that helped us with the grants pretty much through the process, including reviewing grant proposals. And that is each cycle, the who's able to participate has varied a little bit, but this has been the kind of the pool of people that we've drawn from. So Minnesota cattlemen, lamb and wool producers, Farm Bureau, Farmers Union, University of Minnesota, Department of Natural Resources, USDA Wildlife Services. So we've had a good group of people participating on the project. Year one, fiscal year 18, the first year we took applications, we got a really good response. We got 53 applications requesting a little over $600,000. There were a few high asks, but most of those requests were pretty small, $5,000 or less, which was good because that gave us an opportunity to try to help more people with the dollars rather than fewer. If we look at what people are asking for, it broke down like this. The fencing and the shelters were dollar-wise the big requests, and they also tend to be the higher dollar projects, so they cost more to implement. But we got requests throughout all the categories, including guard animals, lights and alarms, and some things that didn't really fit in any of those categories that fell into an other category. What we awarded was similar to what was requested in terms of the distribution, although fencing kind of took a share away from shelters, and that was really some of the big asks that we had were for shelters, and some of them were just we felt like too much money to invest in too little return. So we took an approach of trying to spread the money among more producers and getting more effect that way. In terms of where the money has gone to, this was the first round. We had a lot of grants in particular in northeastern Minnesota in that first round. I think there's maybe 12 counties in total where grants were received in the first round. We ended up with 28 projects that came out of the first round and were completed by June 30th of the first year. And the other thing that we were required to do is to get a report from each of the people that received a grant. And so we created a very simple grant report form, basically asking three questions for each grantee to tell us what your issues have been with wolf depredation, how this project will help, challenges they had regarding the grant process or completing their project, and then basically what do they feel their odds are in the future of this reducing conflicts. In the report we prepared, we included all the information from those grant reports. You can go through verbatim and see what people told us about the project. To summarize, as you would expect, there was a lot of optimism about the projects people did, that they felt that they were going to be helpful, which is good. Otherwise, why would they do them in the first place? But I think by and large, we felt like people had a pretty good experience in terms of working through the grant process and getting their project on the ground. Round two, which was for fiscal year 19, we did a very similar application. Our scoring changed in one way in that we then included a criteria for previous funding. So our goal was to get money to new people. And so we did have people that applied again the second year, but they had basically a lower chance of getting money from already having received money. So we were looking to mix up the grantees, and were successful in doing that. If we look at what was asked for in year two, we had a few fewer applications. We got 39 in fiscal year 19 as opposed to 53 and 18. About the same amount of money overall, a little over $600,000. And so the individual projects tended to be a little bit more expensive in terms of what was being requested in round two. But basically, that breakdown still looks pretty similar overall. Shelters and fencing were the main expenses that are being requested. What we funded in year two was pretty similar to year one. So we're hitting all the categories, but fencing, again, it was a popular thing for people to be proposing, and also it was a little more expensive, so it took up a little bit more of the grant funding. In terms of where proposals went in year two, they shifted a little bit more to northwestern Minnesota. So again, we're trying to get different people receiving funds in these 2 years. Okay, and so that's what happened through the two rounds of funding. And then, we're trying to evaluate what the impact was. And that is something that is a little bit tricky to do, because we're looking at a long period of time that farms maybe had losses, and now a really short period of time that they've maybe had this project completed. So it's not exactly apples to oranges. So what we did is we picked out a subset of projects that we thought would make good comparisons. So these were farms that had losses very recently, and so up until they completed their project, they might have been having losses on their farms basically in the last couple of fiscal years. And then they had a project that was done soon enough that we've had some time after that to look at what the impact has been. So we had this basically 13 projects that we could pick out that had those two criteria: losses right before they finished their project and sometime after they completed their project. So eight were from 18, five from 19. Those were kind of in line with how our overall funding was. Most were fencing, eight. Three were for guard animals, in this case donkeys, although we did have people that did dog projects as well, and two for shelters. And so what we saw is that before the projects were completed, on those 13 farms, we had 24 claims. And after the project, we had five. After the projects were completed, we have five claims. And actually, that's a little bit, three of those were not directly related. So we had one farm that is a sheep and cattle operation, and their project they did was for their sheep pasture, or was related to their sheep, and the losses they had after the project were on cattle. So it's not exactly related to the project. So what we're trying to do here, though, is, again, we solve this problem of more time before the project is completed compared to after. And so what we did to try to standardize that is look at it in terms of a number of days per claim. So what we did is we took all the days that those 13 farms had before their project was completed as a total number of days and a total number of claims. So 24 claims across all of those days. And then we compared that to how many days there were after the project was completed amongst all those farms and how many claims they had. So what we get when we standardize it that way is before the projects were completed, we had about 490 days per claim amongst those 13 farms. And then after the projects were completed, we had about 2,200 days per claim. So the time between claims got stretched out quite a bit for those farms once they did their projects. That's a very small data set. There's a lot of other potential factors that went into that. So it's just perhaps an indicator that those projects were successful, but not definitive proof. One thing that is a little bit of a complicating factor is that overall claims went down in fiscal year 19. So this is statewide. The green arrow is number of claims each fiscal year. The dark blue bars are the amount we're paying out each fiscal year. And then we've got the grants showing up there in the last couple of years as well. But as you can see, fiscal year 19 was lower than 17 and 18 for number of claims and dollar value of claims. And that's statewide, irrespective of a project was being done or not. So our indications from the comparisons we can make at this point are good. But again, there are other things at play as well. Just to go into what's happening now, and so those appropriations ended at the end of the biennium. But we were able to get some federal money to continue offering grants to livestock producers. So this is through Fish and Wildlife Service. We've received money a number of times from Fish and Wildlife to help pay our compensation claims. And so we did again this year, $55,000. But this was the first time that we've received money to fund a grant program. And the reason for that is you had to have an existing grant program in order to apply to the Fish and Wildlife grant program. So having that appropriation and a program put in place at the state level allowed us access to those federal funds. So this year, we're able to get a grant for $70,000 from Fish and Wildlife. Of that, we'll be able to offer $60,000, maybe a little bit more, in grants to producers. And we're right now about to review the proposals we got on that. The one thing that's a little complicated with the federal funds is it's a one-to-one match that's required. So this round of funding that we received, we were able to negotiate with Fish and Wildlife that the money we had already spent on our state program is going to qualify as our match. But if we were to do this, if we were going to apply again in the future, we'll have to figure out how we'll match those funds. Okay, response has been really good. And this latest round as well, we've got less money available, but we got actually more applications than we've ever had in the past. We had 60 applications. About, again, similar amount of money, over $600,000 requested. And the breakdown is very similar to what we've seen in the past. So we've seen kind of a consistent type of interest in producers in participating and in participating in particular types of projects. And with that, that summarizes the information I have about the grant program.
Thank you. Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for this report. Got several questions. I guess the first one, I don't see a fairly clear breakdown here relative to animal species, and there's just a huge difference in the metrics and the complication depending from species to species. So can you at least give us a perspective on obviously sheep, goats, cattle, beef cattle, dairy cattle, and even poultry. There, we used to have a huge amount of problem on the poultry side. I don't see any metrics in here about that.
Mr. Abrahamson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, so yeah, you're right. The information is not in there. So I can tell you from memory that most of the projects were beef cattle and then some sheep. We had some producers who have multiple animals on their farm, so there may have been poultry on their farm, but we didn't have any proposals that I remember that were specific to poultry. If I had ballpark off the top of my head, I would say maybe 75% to 80% were for beef cattle and maybe the remainder for sheep. But we do get claims for all types of livestock, including poultry and whatnot.
Thank you, Mr. Abramson. And Representative Lewick, we do have also the Fuller grant, which might give you more information, but Representative Lewick.
Yeah, thank you. I see there's a lot more detailed information here, literally farm by farm and some of the additional information. Another area that I don't see any information in, particularly because it looks like you develop your metric on days between claims. I don't see a metric in here relative to number of wolves removed relative to the claims. And I can just tell you from many decades of direct experience, the predominant impact that I've seen is nothing to do with, but it's got a lot to do with what you do, but I would say that the absolute driving force is simply a number on the number, the size of that pack. Is it four wolves? Did it expand in 1 year to 11 wolves? And God forbid, did it go beyond that? Because there's just an absolute one-on-one correlation to the kind of devastation that happens, particularly if you bounce over that 7, 8, 9 to a pack. And it becomes, that's where you see some of these huge anomalies in the claims, where all of a sudden somebody loses 16, 17 calves. It's just a massacre. Same with sheep. It literally put them out of business. So did you correlate? I don't see anything here, but right behind these days, I suspect if there was claims, there was clearly some wolves removed from that area.
Mr. Abrahamson.
Madam Chair, thanks. Representative, that's a really good question, and I think that is that's not something that we factored in here, but I think as we try to look at the impact that more of these farms, that is something that we should, a variable that should be included. I agree.
Representative Lewick.
I'm not very pleased to hear that, because that tells me that you better be very, very cautious about drawing any conclusions on exactly what is going on here, because without that information, that's almost like saying, well, the corn looked good, but we didn't count the bushels. I mean, it's that dramatic of a impact. And I say, I've lived with this. I've seen it time and time again. The days or years between claims or having incidents, we know. I mean, we get a pretty good idea, literally, how many wolves are in each of these packs in the area. It's something we've been living with for many decades. And you can literally, it's just literally a one-on-one. The wolf numbers go up, train wrecks happen, in come the federal trappers, and at least for a while we had state trappers were allowed to come in also. They reduce the size of that wolf pack a year, sometimes 2 years, even on a 3 years. Mother Nature tinkers with that too. But, you know, these rascals average 5-6 pups a year, and if normal morbidity doesn't cut that down, you jump from a pair to 6, 7, 8 wolves in a heartbeat. So again, his practical experience from spending a lot of time with a guy named Dr. Dave Meach on the dynamics of this, until you've really matched the other element of what happened to those wolf packs, I just frankly can't draw any positive conclusions that there's an app. I mean, this isn't hurting. I know if you put animals inside, you put a big fence around them, you certainly protect them, and we know that. I mean, a given. But I wish it was just as simple that we could put some flags and lights out there, and that would end this kind of problem. Because, unfortunately, these rascals they will literally learn over time that, oh, the animals are where the lights are. The animals are where the noise are. And they will overcome that fear in a microsecond. I mean, I've seen it directly with how they treat you in the woods when you come upon them. Personal experiences where they just look you over, and it's almost like he knows I can't hurt that rascal, and not that I would. Almost like they figure whether you're armed or not as to how they deal with you face-to-face. I've had to privilege of actually encountering wolves a number of times in the wild, and believe me, they're some of the best animals on the face of earth, sizing up the risk. So anyway, thank you. I appreciate this is good work, don't get me wrong, but we're missing a huge element here without really correlating that data directly to the size of those wolf packs in those farming areas.
I think you can tell that Representative Lewick is a cattleman. We will turn to Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wanted to share with the committee, Representative Tapke carried this bill last session. He's not able to be here this morning because he's presenting other bills, but I just wanted to pass along to the committee that to re-emphasize that $60,000, putting $60,000 into this would allow us to continue to benefit from federal funds. So I just wanted to share that. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Appreciate the experience and knowledge of Representative Lewick in this area. A couple of questions. These are pretty simple questions. I'm curious, what kind of fencing would keep out wolves in a pasture situation?
Mr. Abrahamson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. So they have very actually specific guidelines for fencing. So woven wire fence is the advised method, and then it should be fairly high as well. So it's pretty common. What we typically see is 4 feet of woven wire fence and then a strand of electric on top, maybe another 6 inches above that. So I think that is the specification.
Okay.
Representative Anderson.
One more question. In all of the year's data here, 18, 19, and 20, there seems to be a high correlation cost, like 2-to-1 between animals and veterinary costs. Why the high vet costs to on these animals?
Mr. Abrahamson, are you referring to then something in the grant or the
Well, like the last page on our handout, the animal cost was $20,000 and veterinary cost is $9,700. Why the high cost of veterinary?
Mr. Abrahamson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative, so some of the grantees were asking for veterinary costs for existing guard animals. So if they already had donkeys or dogs in place, they're requesting veterinary costs that they have ongoing. So that means that we're the costs for veterinarian aren't directly related just to the guard animal request in the proposal. So it's like there's more animals that people were asking for vet care than they were asking to purchase animals.
Mr. Representative Anderson.
So were these animals being injured? Is that why the cost was there?
Mr. Abrahamson.
I'm sure. No, it's actually, no, it's preventative care. So vaccinations, hoof trimmings for donkeys, things like that.
All right. Thank you. I don't see any other questions around the table. Thank you, Mr. Abrahamson. Appreciate the information that we have. And this was done a couple of years ago. Representative Hamilton, you recall probably putting this in your bill. So now you can see the fruits of that labor. So that's good. Next week, we're going to, obviously we're running short on time now, potentially, when we have our first deadline. So the policy deadline is next Friday. So we will have the bill with the DE. We heard the MDA's version of the bill. We're going to have a DE amendment for that bill on Tuesday. Then we would have opportunity for any amendments by Thursday. We do have a number of bills that we're going to be hearing next week, and so we'll extend our day until about 12:30. We'll extend our time to be able to be here. May not take that time, but just so that you're aware, if you can adjust your calendars accordingly, that would be good. We weren't able to do the supplemental budget today because it's just coming out, so we'll know more about that next week. We'll be doing that. And today, I believe, the Senate will be acting on RFA. So I think finally we're going to have some action on that. So I'm hopeful that that's going to happen, and then that can go to the governor soon. So unless anyone has any other comments, I think we are through. And everybody have a good weekend. So meeting adjourned.